history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories around you if you just take the time to ask and listen. Each week we visit with veterans of our World War II generation. We want them to know that we appreciate their service and sacrifice, that we're not going to forget the price that was paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman we're going to meet today has quite a story to tell. 91-year-old Al Peguero of Merced, California, and a lifelong resident of Merced, except for a few years that he was across the Pacific with the U.S. Navy on a decorated cruiser known as the USS Reno. We're going to hear about that. But Al, I want to hear about Merced. Now it's a big city. It's got a University of California and all kinds of things going on. But when you're growing up here in the 1930s, what was Merced like?
Oh, real quiet. And everybody was poor and happy. But you know one thing about them? We were afraid of the law. We were afraid of a policeman or a school teacher tell you to do something, you did it. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, the kids do what they want and they get sued and they get one thing or the other if they don't do it.
It's a different world.
It's a different world, right. And you know, in those days, even an uncle would tell you, hey, you do this or do that, you go ahead and do it.
You respected authority.
Right. And nowadays, they'll tell the guy to go, you know, go somewhere else. Yeah. We grew up in downtown Merced on 15th and J. There wasn't much going on. I went to school at Galen Clark School, which is a small school now, if you've seen it. Mm-hmm. Galen Clark. And then I went to John Muir and then to Merced High. And then the war broke out on my second year. The war broke out. I quit school to go to work to make money. There was a lot of people asking for work. I mean, for help, you know.
Mm-hmm. And because a lot of guys went to the service and they needed someone to replace them on those
right.
jobs.
In fact, my first job was help build the Japanese labor camp they had over there by the fairgrounds.
Really?
They made some real quick homes to put those people away, but that was the wrong thing.
The Merced Assembly Center.
Right.
There's a memorial to it now at the fairgrounds here in Merced.
Right. And that's what my first job, and I was only 17 then, and they put me to work, helped build those buildings.
What do you remember about that? Because it was almost your birthday. Your birthday is the 15th of December, but right. The 7th of December, the world changed. How did you find out about that?
I was working on my jalopy. I had a Model A jalopy that my dad gave me, and I was painting it. And I heard over the radio that we got attacked in Pearl Harbor. And everybody kept saying, well, where's Pearl Harbor? We didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was. The kids that I knew, our world was Fresno, Merced, Las Banas, and Modesto, and over here by the foothills, that was our home. We never knew nothing about Pearl Harbor or anything like that.
You probably even remember Yosemite before it was crawling with tourists from all over the world.
Well, we got to go to, I had an uncle working for the railroad. They go to Yosemite, mm-hmm. and they had a camp for them to live in up in the hills, El Portel.
Yeah.
My uncle and my grandmother lived there, so we had to go visit them, which were real nice, you know.
I know you had a big family, had a couple brothers and three sisters. Do you remember having some ambitions, some dreams that, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this?
No, we never thought about that. Remember, we was happy to have a bicycle and get around. No, we never thought about the future at all.
Hmm. So Pearl Harbor happens.
Yeah, Pearl Harbor.
And I'm sure in going to school here in Merced that you had some classmates who were Japanese American.
Yes, and they were real good people. They got a raw deal. In fact, I still know a few of them that are still here, and they're real nice people that got just a raw deal.
And here you're over here, you finally have a job to help to support the family.
Yeah.
And then now you have the perspective of what that job was and what it meant for the Japanese Americans.
Yeah. After a while, they put them in those buildings for a while. Then they shipped them out.
Right. This was the assembly center to round them all up and then shipped from there to internment camps.
Right. In Colorado somewhere they had different. And then some of those kids volunteered to go into the Army and fight in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
See, a lot of them went to fight in Europe.
The 442nd, very decorated there.
The most decorated outfit in the Army.
That's correct.
And I knew some of them just at a distance. I remember that there were very few of them, and they were all hard workers, farming. Most of them were in farming. They tried real hard, and that was a raw deal. But there were some real good people.
So you quit school to work
right
after Pearl Harbor.
Uh-huh.
When did you realize that you were probably going to have to be a part of what was going on in this fight?
No, we thought the war would be over in a month. Yeah, yeah, we thought the war it was just going to be a temporary deal. Before I knew it, I turned 18, which was a year later, December the 15th, and then I went and registered, and in about 3 months I got my notice to show up in Fresno. And when we got there, they told us that we'd have a choice. If we passed examinations and everything, we have a choice of where we want to go do. And when I got to my turn, I told them I'd have to go Navy. I never seen the ocean in my life. I didn't know what it was like. That I was going to have to go to the Navy. When I went through, they said, okay. They passed me on through, and then at the other end of the line, here I meet a cousin that I hardly ever seen or talked to hardly. He was a little bit older than me, maybe a couple of years older than me. And I told him, where are you going, cousin? He said, I'm going Navy. How about you? He said, oh, I'm going Navy too. Okay, I said, well, we'll see you later. And we thought that was the end of the conversation. And next thing I knew, when they got through with me, they told me, go home, get your things ready, and come back in a week. And we went back in a week to Fresno, and they put it on a train, and there's my cousin again. Where are you going, cousin? He said, I'm going to Farragut, which is up in Idaho.
Yeah.
And we ended up together in the same boot camp, and we had about 100 men. I got a picture there. In 3 months from there, they sent us to San Francisco, to Treasure Island, and that's where they were getting the crew ready for the Reno. They had a crew of 750 men. From there, we went to school to the rifle range in Vallejo. So I guess they were 30-06, and then we went into the 40 millimeters and 20 millimeters, and the big guns, the 5-inch, were up at Half Moon Bay, and we had to go to Half Moon Bay and shoot the big guns, and they keep track of everything you did, you know. They put you where they wanted to. They knew where you did the best job. And then all of a sudden, the time to go board ship, my cousin's there, same outfit, same on the same turret.
Same gun crew.
Same gun crew.
On the ship of 750, the
yeah.
gun crew that you're assigned to, your cousin's on that crew.
Yeah.
What are the odds of that?
Well, a million, I guess.
And they didn't do it on purpose.
No.
They didn't know you guys were cousins.
Yeah, we told them, they just kind of looked at us, you know, looked the other way. It's like, you know, those days, too, there was a lot of kids that were lying about their age.
Right.
And they were 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And there were quite a few of them. You could look at their faces. There was young kids. They all ended up going. They would grab them. They wouldn't let them go home unless somebody complained. We had a kid that his sisters complained to the congressman or something back in Texas, and they found a kid aboard our ship.
Mm.
And he just turned 18 16 when he went in. He lied. He lied about his age. And then people would sign for him.
Right.
The Navy would care less. Once you got in, they wanted you.
They needed bodies.
They needed bodies. They put you where they wanted to. And here it is, my cousin and I ended up in the same gun crew. I handled the powder and he handled the shell for the same gun. The whole crew on top, and then the 5-inch guns are up there on top. And that's the one that turns, it goes each way, you know, up and
right.
down. Well, we were the next step down. We had to get the powder from the, there'd be a hole coming out of the main deck. And you grab them and you put them on another shelf. And that would go to the guy that would throw it in the gun. There were quite a few people involved in there.
It's a big operation to get these giant shells.
Oh, yeah. My division had about 100 men, the first division. And we had 3 turrets in the front. We had plenty of help. And we'd sleep in a room about big as this, I guess, more or less. There were about 30 of us sleeping in there.
And you mentioned having your cousin on your crew.
Yeah.
You also had quite a few guys from your hometown. I mean, here's a ship of 750. How many guys from Merced on that ship?
9.
9 of you from this little town in California.
Town, yeah. And the one guy that, his name was Sid Johnson, he is in the engine room. He worked on the engines. And then we had another guy named S.V. Smith. He was on a 5-inch 30 cannon, too, like I was. They were scattered throughout the whole ship. Mm-hmm. Some were on the 20 millimeter, so nine of us scattered out. And then when we got hit that night, real bad was in the Philippines. The second time we got hit, I looked around. I found S.V. Smith right away, and I found my cousin. We were together. They wouldn't let us abandon ship. They made us clean the ship on one side. We throw everything over the side, and the other side we carry whatever we carry there to balance the ship.
Yeah, because it was listing.
Yeah.
So you guys got hit pretty bad, and I want to hear about all that.
Yeah.
But I'm interested first in what it was like. Here you said your whole world was within a 30 or 40 mile radius of Merced.
Yeah.
Now you're on this big cruiser, 750 men, and you're heading out to war. You're a teenager. What's going through your mind when you guys set sail from San Francisco?
We thought it was just a big good time trip, you know. We thought it was fun and all that. We never worried about getting hit or losing any men, as far as that goes. And when we left San Francisco, another cruiser took us out. I think it was the Oakland. The Oakland was the same type of ship. We joined the fleet in the Pacific. But we never worried about it. You know who the guys that were mostly? Were the guys that were married.
Right.
The guys that were married. Because we had, like our crew captain, his last name was Caps. He was afraid whenever we got into battle. You could see it, that he was worried. And sure, he knew that one mistake would be, basically, to get the powder kegs were about that big, and they had a primer. If you hit that primer, that'd be it.
It would explode.
Right in the same room.
Mm-hmm.
See? So, and we were kids. We didn't think nothing of it. We thought it was just a fun trip.
When did that change? What was that first moment where it became clear to you, hey, this is real, and we could lose our lives?
I guess when we got hit, the first time we got hit, we didn't feel it. I was in the front part of the ship, and the torpedo plane was empty, and it hit that turret in the back, and it came over the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew we got hit, but we didn't feel it. But when we got hit that night, in fact, it was about 2 weeks after the invasion of the Philippines. There was rumors that we had sunk all the Jap fleet, that the Jap fleet that were left were going to wait for us at the mainland. We didn't think nothing of it. And I was asleep. It was midnight. We got hit at 11:30 at night. And I was asleep when that ship shook like a fish out of water. It just shook and knocked me on the deck. Usually we'd get a warning when there was an enemy nearby. We'd get a warning. And that night we didn't get no kind of warning, nothing. It just shook the ship out of the ground, out of the water. And I fell on the deck. And boy, everybody put their clothes on. And the captain called battle stations. He wouldn't abandon ship. Only one guy abandoned ship was a chief petty officer. He was on deck when we got hit. So he grabbed a raft.
Mm-hmm.
And threw over the side. He went over the side. He was only one guy that went over the side.
But when they sound battle stations, they sound general quarters, so that you have to go to your 5-inch gun?
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it's still dark outside.
Oh, yeah. It was dark. And some of the lights were going off and on. Some lights were off and on. We was about two decks below water, our living quarters. Everybody just found our way to our battle stations. You could go straight up. Or go down the road inside.
Mm-hmm. But was there anything to fire at?
No.
Because this was torpedoes from a submarine that had hit you.
Yeah. But the captain was the one that decided that, made that decision. He called battle stations, and he thought we were going to get hit again. And then we heard that he turned down orders to abandon. He said he was going to take his ship home.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost 48 men. They were in that area where the torpedo hit. So it took us about 3 days to get it stabilized in the water. And when we straightened it out, here comes a tugboat out of the Philippines. I got pictures there of it. Tightened up cables on there and towed it all the way to the Marshall Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And we towed it at, I think it was 2 knots an hour. And we had towed all the way to the Marshall Islands, which was about 600 miles away at 2 miles an hour.
That's a slow journey.
Well, a slow journey. We had four destroyers around us, and they picked up all the survivors. They made everybody abandon. You can see where they abandoned ship. They started picking them up the next day, and some guy wouldn't go over. You could look over the side of the ship, and you could see the sharks down there.
Mm.
They were going into the same hole that that the torpedo made.
The water was clear enough to see sharks swimming into the holes in your ship that the torpedoes had left.
We had them around us for days.
And the way a lot of the guys evacuated your ship was they had lines from your ship to these destroyers.
Right.
They'd jump in the water and then follow the line to the destroyer.
And a lot of guys didn't want to go over, and they'd grab them and throw them over.
Wow. But you didn't have to do it that way.
No.
Why not?
Me and my buddy Lino, our captain, we had a lieutenant. I mean, he put us on the tugboat. He put about 50 men on the tugboat so we could help out. Mm-hmm. And our job was, I remember, was we had axes to cut the cable loose if it starts sinking.
Ah.
If the Reno would start sinking or get hit again, you had to get rid of it right away.
Well, that doesn't sound like a fun job. Your whole job is to be ready for something really disastrous.
Right.
And have to do something that probably would have been tough to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and we was on there 24 hours. The first thing I did, I met the cook on the tugboat, and I started talking to him in Spanish, and him and I were buddies from there on. Yeah. And then those guys had fresh eggs. They had fresh, good food compared to ours. Our food was mostly all powder.
Mm-hmm.
On the cruiser, everything was powder. The bread was powder, the milk, and everything was powder. And then just throw a little bit of water, and that's what you ate. Because they carried enough food for 6 weeks. We go for 6 weeks without stopping.
Right.
And we had to carry food for 700 men.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll learn more about the USS Reno and just how fortunate that cruiser was to survive World War II. What does that mean for Al Peguero? Well, I'm sure you can imagine. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to see what he looked like then and what he looks like now, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 91-year-old Al Peguero. He's spent his whole life in Merced, California, except for 3 years in the Navy in World War II. His ship, the light cruiser USS Reno, put together quite a track record in the final 15 months of World War II. 541 feet long and loaded with firepower, the Reno supported aircraft carriers throughout the Pacific. Guam, Saipan, Tinian, Iwo Jima, you name it. In October 1944, the Reno shot down 6 Japanese planes off of Formosa and escaped major damage when an enemy torpedo plane crashed into her fantail. 10 days later, during the Battle of Leyte Gulf, Al Peguero and the crew of the Reno witnessed the tragic end of the USS Princeton, an aircraft carrier that took a direct hit from a Japanese bomb and was engulfed in flames. The Reno was one of 4 ships that would suffer their own damage while trying to fight the fire on the Princeton, but that carrier could not be saved, and the Reno was ordered to fire torpedoes to sink her. In another 10 days, the Reno came close to suffering that same fate when a Japanese submarine caught everyone off guard in the middle of the night, using a torpedo to blast a giant hole in the side of Al Peguero's ship. You're telling this story about the night you guys were hit, and you lived through it, and you've told this story a few times, but I'm imagining people hearing this for the first time. They want to understand, A, how bad it was, and B, how bad it could have been if it didn't happen just the way it was. And correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't I read that There was also a torpedo that struck your ship but didn't detonate and was actually lodged in the hull?
I didn't know that part. When we got hit, it was 11:30 at night, and I know it shook me out of bed.
Right.
And I fell on the deck, and I got up and I grabbed my pants first. Some guys didn't even put their clothes on. Some guy was in the shower, taking a shower, and they just ran naked to the battle stations. I grabbed a pair of pants that I had hanging by my bunk and got put them on and went to my battle stations. But it didn't take long. Everybody was in battle stations in a matter of minutes.
Did you ever have a chance to look at the damage from those torpedoes?
Yes. But we didn't even think of nothing of it. From the Marshall Islands, they patched us up, a little bit of patching up. And then from there, we went to some islands called the Amity Islands, which were British. And that's where they had that floating dry dock.
The only reason I ask is so you can tell people listening how bad the damage was to your ship and maybe how worse it could have been.
Oh, yeah. If it had hit the magazine, it would have been it. As far as I heard, like the Juno, that's the one that took the five brothers down. Mm-hmm. We heard it. We took about 600 guys with it when they blew up bad.
So if this torpedo had hit in a little different spot, it could have claimed 10 times as many lives.
Oh, yeah.
You might not
be
here right now.
Right.
And you had seen that firsthand with other ships. You guys were there when the Princeton was hit.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about that.
Uh-huh.
I imagine that was kind of hard to forget.
Yeah,
can you tell us about that night when the Princeton was hit?
Well, when the Princeton was hit, it was during the daytime when we sunk it. We fought fire in the morning. It got hit early in the morning, and we fought the fire for 3 or 4 hours, and we just couldn't put the fire out.
So you guys are on your ship?
On our ship with hoses. I got pictures there of the ship with the hoses.
What were you doing during that time?
We were watching the firemen, and we were dumb because we was there watching the firemen, and we could see them from here to the trees there. They were fighting the fire.
Yeah.
And then we pulled away. I don't know why, what reason we pulled away. The Reno did pull away, and by the time we got from here to maybe a block, it blew up, and they claimed that they killed about 400 guys that were fighting the fire from the Birmingham, from other ships that were on the Princeton fighting the fire. When it blew up, it killed about 400 guys. But we didn't see that. We were from here to by the parking lot.
Well, there was that, where guys on another ship were killed in an explosion. There was also, as I understand, a time while you guys are fighting this fire that you're so close that the carrier deck of the Princeton actually took out one of your guns on your ship, right?
Yeah, we lost a 40-millimeter, but I think it was on the bumps, you know, twisting.
As the water is rocking you back and forth.
Yeah.
So then you pull away at just the right time to avoid this other explosion.
Right. We pull away, then straighten out and come back in. I don't know why they let us stand out on the main deck watching the firefighters. Yeah, that was a big mistake there, too. Not the safest place to be. We should have been in our own, below decks, or in our own gun turrets. The mount on that 5-inch 38, they're about 2.5 inch thick, that metal.
Yeah.
So we could be pretty safe, man, from a blowing up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why nobody thought of it, but then.
Again, you're seeing a lot of things and experiencing a lot of things that you never have before. You're still
right.
Just a teenager. But what did that look like? I mean, how unbelievable was that scene that you were looking at? Can you describe for us what it looked like?
Well, it was just a big fire, and we could tell we wouldn't gain nothing from it. There were two destroyers and two cruisers with the hoses fighting the fire, you know, from both sides. Nobody was thinking they were going to blow up.
But then they did learn after that explosion. They said, well, we can't have this happen again. So then they make the decision, well, we need to sink the Princeton.
Yeah, they gave the Princeton, the Reno orders to sink it. As far as I know, I heard we hit it two times. We carried torpedoes.
Yeah.
We do have a set of three on each side in the front, and they gave us orders to sink it. So we pulled away from here to the parking lot, and we hit it.
So your ship gets the orders to sink another American ship.
Yeah.
To avoid further devastation and loss.
Right.
I mean, this has to be a pretty morbid day. I mean, was this hard to believe that this was all happening?
Oh, yeah. You know, couldn't believe we hit one of our own ships. Can you imagine a carrier? You could see the planes were on the decks, on the main deck.
Yeah.
That never got off. And so it was a big loss, big loss. You know, Carrier was the most important one, important ship aboard in the fleet.
Yeah.
Because of the planes it carried.
And it's not like today where you've got a phone in your hand that can tell you, well, this is what's happening at all these other places. The only thing you know about the war is what you're seeing there right in front of your eyes.
Right.
That had to be a little demoralizing.
Yeah. We, like I said, we go, you know, after it happened, yeah, we knew it was a mistake. And we lucked out because we pulled away. But if we hadn't pulled away, we'd have been right among them when it blew up. I don't know why they didn't expect that. They should have expected it because there was airplanes on fire.
There are a lot of things to fuel that fire.
Right.
And to explode. So those are a couple of the real memorable experiences that you and the crew of the Reno had. Mm. What about the day-to-day? And when you guys are shelling islands for an invasion, or you know, there's situations where some of your other gun crews probably would do this more. You're firing at enemy aircrafts, trying to make sure a kamikaze doesn't come through. When those kind of situations are going and you're doing your job on that 5-inch gun, what was that like? What were the things you had to do?
We loaded the guns, our guns. They shoot them and we keep loading them as fast as they needed. The gun is controlled by somebody up above us.
Right.
When they would start shooting, that when they would give orders to, you know, to be prepared to. And we'd be getting more ammunition from the main deck below there. And then our walls would be all ammunition, all around inside of us, in the turret.
Mm-hmm.
All around us, there'd be powder barrels, and then there'd be shells. And then those shells would have a combination that they can be set at so high it would blow up.
Right.
And so all that was going on at that same time. And we were just kids. We didn't think nothing of it. We didn't think we could get hit.
Thought you were invincible, huh?
Right.
So you're two levels below the deck?
Yeah.
And you're putting the powder in? Or you're handing the powder to somebody else?
Yeah, handing the powder to somebody else. We took it from the main magazine down below us.
Mm-hmm.
There were guys down the bottom of the ship, inside the ship, way in the bottom, getting the ammunition and putting it on a conveyor going to us. We took it out as fast as we needed. And then our walls would be covered, shells and powder. We put those where the guy need them.
So I'm just trying to imagine what it was like. It sounds like it was kind of nonstop. Once you started, you just kept passing it to the next guy over and over and over again, right?
Just put them on, yeah.
Was that tiring?
No, we never thought. It was noisy.
I bet it was. What did that sound like?
Oh, gee. A 5-inch. Big, pretty big lounge. And then we didn't have no protection.
Nothing on your ears.
Nothing on our ears. And I lost my hearing on my right side here. But we didn't think nothing of it. We just kept going.
I'm just trying to add a little perspective for folks who've never been in a 5-inch gun turret on a big cruiser like that. Have you ever heard any noise anywhere else in the world that compares to the noise of that gun going off?
No. No, I don't think so. No more noise louder than that. And then there were three sets of guns together.
Right.
One top of the other.
So you hear one, then you hear the next, then you hear the next.
And each one, I guess, as far as I know, there was an officer on the main deck that was controlling that turret. When he needed it, he pulled the trigger.
Just for comparison, how do you think it would compare to me grabbing two pans from your kitchen and slamming you on both ears with them?
I think it'd be pretty close.
Probably be pretty similar.
Yeah.
But this is over and over and over again the whole time you're in the Pacific.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how did you get along with all those other guys on the ship?
Good. We was all buddies. There were very few guys that didn't get along with each other, but most of us got along like brothers. And we was the best of friends. We joke around with each other and wrestle with each other in the main deck.
Mm-hmm.
Just we was only between 18 and 20.
Right.
When I went in, I just turned 18. And there we had kids that were 16 and 17 when they went in.
You mentioned speaking a little Spanish. I'm sure you and your cousin Lino could throw a little Espanol back and forth.
Yeah.
But I bet most of the rest of the crew didn't know what you guys were talking about.
Right. There's very few Mexicans on there. There might have been maybe a dozen on the whole ship, but we were separated, you know, so we never see each other.
So November 3rd, 44, you guys are torpedoed. You mentioned 48 sailors lost their lives.
Right.
Did you know any of those guys?
Yeah. I got pictures of them there. When the ship got hit, the automatic went out in the ocean on their own, you know what I mean? Some died where we could put them in boxes, wrap them around with a cloth and a weight. The way I understood, they put like a 5-inch 38 shell, they must weigh about 50 pounds, and they wrap them around the guys, and then they put them over the side, down they go.
Burial at sea.
Yeah. Burial at sea.
How hard was that? I mean, these are guys you've been on this ship with, knew personally.
Yeah, and then some. I helped carry some of them that night. The officers give us orders to pack one guy over here and try to help the guys that were hurt. Something like that goes real fast. And sure, there were some guys I knew real well. One guy from Fresno, his name was Young, and before we left, he went and got married, and he never made it back. I didn't see him when it happened. But when it was over with, we knew who didn't make it.
So you think of that widow who never really got to have her husband.
I thought about going to see the family sometimes, and then I put it off. What do you say? I mean, all you say is how it happened that we got hit at 11:30 at night in the Philippines.
Well, when you talk about, you know, those 48 men who lost their lives and... Yeah. A gentleman you just mentioned who had been newly married and all that, and you're actually carrying some of these guys and moving them around your ship, and then you watch them buried at sea.
Buried at sea.
And you hear the bugler play taps.
Yeah, I got pictures there when they buried them.
What goes through your mind in those moments?
It could be me. It could be me, and you know what's going to happen. It's going to go down so far, and the sharks are going to get it. All that goes through your mind. What else can you do? I mean, see, between the time we got hit and the time we got to the Marshall Islands, it was about 2 weeks later, see? How can you keep them?
Well, and yeah, exactly. So you had to bury them there.
Yeah.
But that brings up another point. As slow as you guys had to go when you're being towed after they've righted the ship somewhat, so you're not listing as badly, but you're still a damaged ship. You've got no power. You're getting tugged all the way there.
Yeah.
That was probably pretty scary, too, because if any of these enemy ships come around, I mean, you guys are a sitting duck.
See, we had four destroyers went around us for protection.
But when you had been hit, you'd had just as much protection, right?
Oh, yeah.
You guys had a bunch of guys around you then.
Yeah. I don't know how that submarine got in. What they probably done there, they see us coming in the horizon, and they just wait for whoever gets closest to them. And don't make no noise. Mm. Nobody will pick them up. When we got hit, we must have had about three carriers and maybe a dozen destroyers and three or four cruisers, because each carrier usually carry a cruiser to help them for any aircraft. When we got hit, nobody picked it up. Usually somebody will pick it up, and boy, the noise will come on, you know, battle stations.
Right. I get the sense that you have a lot of respect for your captain because he was given by his superiors the option to abandon ship, and he refused.
Yeah. He said, no, I'm taking my ship home. My first job was when we got hit. I went on a tugboat with Lino, and I were together. I don't know why they kept us together, and we was on there for about 12, 14 days, and we got back to the Marshall Islands where we had a repair ship, and I went on a repair ship to help. We patched up that hole.
You were part of that, patching up the hole on the Reno?
Yeah.
What'd you guys have to do? Cut some sheet metal?
Put sheet metal and put a whole new patch. They patched it up. That was underwater. And then from there, we went to the Amity Islands. And that's where they put us on that floating dry dock. It's a big, they pick up two cruisers.
Yeah.
I guess it took about a month there just doing that. From there, we went to Hawaii. We came back to Hawaii. We had everything covered up. All our numbers were covered. Letters, anything was all covered up. So they wouldn't know who it was. We loaded up and we came to San Pedro. All the guys from the West Coast, California, Texas, Arizona, Seattle, all them guys from their area, we got off. They let us go home. And they give us a month pay. And they gave us a month and traveling time to catch the Reno at South Carolina.
I bet your mom was happy to see you.
Oh, yeah. In fact, we stopped in San Pedro. We horsed around there and we hitchhiked home, the three of us. Another guy named Lefty and Lino and I, the three of us came together from there hitchhiking. And it would be hard to get a ride for three guys at one time. And we finally got home. And it was dark. It was real dark. It was already 8, 9 o'clock at night time in the wintertime. I seen my sister go crazy with the lights on and everything. It all went crazy, and they heard us coming home. I never forgot that day when we got home.
So you're home, but you know you're going to have to go back, and you probably thought you had more combat in front of you.
Well, we thought we'd get there, and the ship would be ready to go again. It wasn't quite ready.
And by the time it was, the war was over, but the Reno still had an important role to play, and we'll hear about it when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos and even a short video with Al, and we'll have the rest of his story, including how his honor flight experience produced a special reunion with a piece of his ship when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. If you're an RVer, you've probably heard about the new line of Grand Design fifth wheels, travel trailers, and toy haulers. What sets Grand Design apart is the long list of premium standard features you'll find on the entire line. You'll also find the largest selection of Grand Design RVs at Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old Al Peguero of Merced, California, Navy veteran of World War II, having served on the light cruiser USS Reno. If you ever end up in City Hall in Reno, Nevada, you'll find the ship's bell, and there's another piece of that cruiser in Washington, D.C. We're going to hear about that shortly, but let's pick up where we left off. It took 7 months' worth of repairs in Charleston, South Carolina, for the Reno to be ready to return to action, and that's what happened in October 1945. More than a month after the Japanese had signed those surrender documents.
The war was over. We happened to hit a Navy Day in Galveston, Texas. We went in a parade, and we opened the ship to the public. And people came aboard ship to see the ship. And we was there a few days, and then they sent us to New York to go to France and England to bring GIs home for Christmas of 1945.
Yeah, you guys were the magic carpet, right?
Yeah, magic carpet. We got across the Atlantic in about 5 days. The one we hit a storm, it took us about 10 days. We go like that, and then go clear down to like that. Just about sunk to, I don't know what the captain was thinking of. Because they hit the North Atlantic in the middle of December. That's rough, real rough.
You mentioned being in Galveston and the parade and people coming on your ship and everything. What did that mean to you that the war was over?
Oh, yeah, that we were going home soon. We was on points. The older you were, the more points you had. Or if you seen more action or Purple Heart, anything like that, all that would help you. I forgot, a married man was about 20 points. And, you know, some guys just got married coming back. They got married about a month before the war was over. So they lucked out. And we figured, well, our turn to come up. And before I knew it, we was in France and England. And we brought home our GIs home from there to New York, drop them off, put on a load of new GIs, take them back to France, and get another bunch of old guys, bring them back, see, back and forth.
Were some of those guys you brought home the liberated prisoners of war?
No, but there were some guy went and smuggled a passenger, a kid about 12, 14. I got a picture of him, too. They smuggled him aboard ship. They dressed him like a GI, but by the third day he came out. As far as I know, he stayed in the United States.
As far as just the news, you know, VJ Day, Japan has surrendered. this war is over.
Uh-huh.
Had there been days where you weren't sure that was ever going to happen?
No.
You always believed.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, when we first went in, I didn't think that the war was going to last very long. See, mm-hmm. Imagine Japan attacking the United States. No, hard to believe. When we hit the islands, you couldn't count the ships that we had. We would leave, we'd take off maybe 4 carriers, 4 cruisers, and a dozen destroyers. Next day you wake up, there'd be twice as many. The further you see, the more ships of ours you see. So when we hit the Philippines that time, I mean, you couldn't count the ships aboard from one end to the other. So many of them.
You saw the strength of our Navy, and that gave you confidence.
Right, yeah. And we were kids, like I said, we always thought that there wouldn't be no match to us. We just never thought that they would even hit us. We got hit that night, we never thought there could be that much. Now, the Jap plane, they hit us. It was an empty torpedo plane.
Well, he had tried to fire his torpedo and hit you, and he missed,
yeah,
right?
Right.
And then he came back around and crashed into the...
Crashed into the ship.
Yeah.
He went into... He tried to hit the bridge, is where all the brains are at. He ended up hitting the fantail, and he hit the turret number 6, and he burned a lot of guys in there. In fact, the guy that got burned the worst was about 3 decks below. And he was sitting under a fan, and he was on damage control. And when that plane hit that air vent, it sucked gas and everything down to where he was at, and burning real bad. Oh. I don't know if he survived or not.
Well, and if that had been your gun turret it hit, you might have been burned.
Yeah.
But you were on the other end of the ship.
Right.
So the war ends, and you make all these trips back and forth across the Atlantic to bring American GIs home that have been fighting in Europe.
Right.
And then eventually you get out also.
Right. We went to Panama, and then from Panama went all the way around to Everett, Washington. We left the ship there, and they begged us to stay in. They offered us a rate, money, vacation, everything, if we would re-sign. And as far as I know, 2 guys signed, but we had a small crew by then.
Because you needed all the space for those guys you're bringing home.
Right.
Yeah.
And those poor guys be in the deck sick, real sick. I mean, the poor guys were dying. They were seasick.
Well, they weren't Navy guys. They were Army guys.
Army
guys.
You're
in a storm.
Yeah.
So then when you get home, was it easy to go back to being a civilian, or was that kind of a challenge for you to make that transition?
Well, to me it was easy because I was still a single man, and I went and stayed with my father and mother.
You worked on the farm?
I worked on the farm. I looked for a job. I kept looking for a job, and jobs were hard to find. So I just helped them on the ranch, and then eventually I started working in construction and farming, part-time farming and part-time construction.
You guys had what, tomatoes, cotton?
Tomatoes and bell peppers.
Uh-huh.
And my dad had about 8 milk cows. I never milked them. He milked them. In those days, they put the milk in the 10-gallon cans, and the truck would come by and pick them up every so often, and twice a day.
And the construction work you did, a lot of it was at what was then Castle Air Force Base.
Right, mostly Castle, yeah. And I met the boss there real good. Him and I got along real good. His name was Dick Fredrickson. He learned how to put the lights on the runways.
Uh-huh.
And then I'd have cement wall about that wide. And down in there would be the power going through.
Right. And so what you worked on there was helping to install the lights on the runways.
Right. And the approach lights. And fuel tanks.
Uh-huh.
Oh, he had some big fuel tanks, and they were all underground.
Well, and the reason that strikes me is here you are in 1946, 47, whatever,
yeah,
working on this runway at what forever was Castle Air Force Base, a very important strategic base throughout the Cold War. It is decommissioned in the mid-1990s. And then 20 years later, you're back on that runway that you worked on once upon a time because that's where your Central Valley Honor Flight took off.
Yeah. Well, right now, Obama was there about a month ago.
He was, yeah, visiting Yosemite. Yeah. So that runway's seen a lot of traffic over the years.
Okay, imagine what it costs. Ooh, that's cement. Must be that thick.
So the Honor Flight, you go with 65 other World War II veterans to Washington, D.C. Your son goes with you as your guardian.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? What was that experience like?
It was a real good trip. And then I lucked out. My son went with me. We had real good weather. We went all over Washington. And then my brother-in-law's brother helped us get to the museum. They wouldn't let us go in.
So there's a Navy museum in Washington, D.C., but it's on the Navy Yard that's an active base. So you need special clearance to get in and see this museum. It's not something the public has access to, but there was something there at that museum really wanted to see.
Yeah, we wanted to see that turret.
A turret, not just any 5-inch gun turret, but one from your ship, the Reno.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And it's got our name on there, our ship name on there.
What was that like to be with that here on a trip where you're already having all these memories come back, and then you see guns from your ship?
Yeah, it was something, yeah.
What did you think about when you were standing there next to it?
It made me feel real proud of it. And it was highly damaged. All I heard was that it was a little crossways. The plane hit that turret, knocked one gun out of whack. Mm-hmm. But we kept using it. Mm-hmm. We still used it. We still shoot everything with it.
I want to ask you more about some of the things you did on that trip, but just in general, as you're doing all this with a son who wouldn't have been born if you didn't make it home from the war.
Yeah.
You never would have met your wife. You'd go on to have 4 kids. Now you've got 10 grandkids. One of your grandsons is at the Naval Academy.
Yeah.
Now, does it hit you that...
You
told me when you saw those guys, when 48 guys were killed on your ship, one of the thoughts was it could have been me.
Oh, yeah. It is. You had to be... We lucked out. The whole ship lucked out because the gun didn't blow up. And that was one dangerous thing about AA cruisers. When they were overloaded with guns. They're a brand new ship.
When you say AA cruiser, you mean anti-aircraft. The whole design of your ship was to take out the enemy planes. Yeah.
And so we were overgunned.
Right.
We had a lot of ammunition. We knew that because then they lost 3 of them right away.
So you guys knew that you were kind of a floating bomb. And then you get hit by torpedoes, but you don't blow up.
Right, didn't blow up. And he hit it right in the center of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
We got hit right in the middle of the ship. The ship was always, one-third was always on duty. That night I had to shift for 4 o'clock in the morning, the next morning. When they shook me out of bed, the guy said, there's somebody hit us, that some other ship had rammed into us. But no, it shook like that. It went sideways, and it went round and round. We still had an engine going.
Yeah.
But we could control the ship. And
while that was all going on, were you scared?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. We were just dumb kids. I was only about 19 then or 20. We didn't think nothing of it. We just did whatever they told us to.
And on this honor flight, I mean, the whole idea is to get you guys there to see this World War II memorial that wasn't built until 60 years after the war. And most World War II veterans have never had a chance to see it.
Right.
When you got to that memorial with your son and you looked at everything, the fountain, the pillars for each state, and that wall of gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who didn't get to come home like you did.
Oh, yeah.
What did you think about while you were there at that memorial?
Yeah. No, it made me proud.
Did you have any strangers come up to you?
Oh, yeah. I still do. I still have people come and thank me. And then I was in a parade in by Morro Bay. Cayucas,
yeah.
Okay, you ever been there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, they have a big parade there. I was watching the parade, and here comes a pretty girl and grabbed me and kissed me. I mean, it made me think right away, gee, you're real nice. I mean, first class. And she came over and thanked me and kissed me, and it surprised the hell out of me. Yeah.
That's a good day.
And then I had other people come and thank me.
Mm-hmm.
I still do. I mean, even down here in town, sometimes I meet somebody and they'll come out and say they want to thank me for being there. You know, I'm glad I went. And I say I never was afraid.
On that honor flight, when you landed back at Castle,
uh-huh.
And you got off that plane, I mean, you're not going through a terminal or anything. Yeah. You walk off that plane right there on the tarmac. What did you see?
The people were real happy. They gave it a real good reception. And once in a while, I heard my name. Somebody called my name out. In fact, somebody called me and said that I was on the Reno. They knew who I was and what ship I was on. It made me feel real good.
Here's a column of flags for about 50 yards.
Yeah.
And you've got cheerleaders in their uniforms and the bands playing.
Yeah, everything like that. Yeah, all that.
It's just basically sunset.
Uh-huh.
Pretty striking scene.
Yeah.
Did it make you feel like you were important?
Yeah, like I'd done the right thing. People hollered my name, and some people I didn't even see who they were. And I know some of my neighbors, They were there. Well, my daughter was there. Who else? There were about four or five of my family there. It made me feel good. No, I'm glad I went. I'm real glad that I went. I was always proud of it.
Well, I want to say something that I'm pretty sure you heard a lot on the honor flight, but I want to say it myself. I want to say thank you for serving our country and for telling us a little bit about it. Is there something that you think we need to know, those of us who didn't live through World War II? What did that tell you about America and what people here are made out of?
Well, everybody that I knew that was in the service, Army or Navy, whatever, everybody was real happy to go. You know, I was surprised that there were so many kids, 16 years of age or so, lying to get in. I remember the one guy they caught from Texas, Mexican kid. So when they caught up with him, we was already going. We was in Pearl Harbor when they came in and took him in. His sisters pushed the congressman to find him.
Yeah.
He was 16. Uh-huh. But he cried. He didn't want to go home.
Yeah.
He wanted to stay with the ship. We felt bad about it that you know, he couldn't stay. But I know that the sisters were right too, you know.
Yeah, trying to protect their brother.
Yeah.
What would you say you're most proud of?
Well, the uniform and everything, as far as that goes. Yeah. No, I'm glad I went. I just don't want my grandkids to go fight a war right now that they have it over there in the Middle East. We don't know who's on our side or what.
Well, and you have a grandson at the Naval Academy right now.
Yeah, right now. And he's the youngest of my grandsons. I'm real proud of him. And you know what? I got to tell my kids, they don't believe it. We used to get $2 a day. That was our pay. I went to Fresno, see if I can get some glasses that would be better than the ones I got.
At the VA?
At the VA.
Yeah.
So I went down there, and I got this little Japanese girl, real, real nice. And she kept working on my glasses, until she got one that's perfect. And my daughter said, how do you feel getting that free? I said, well, I didn't get them free, mija. I told her, you know, I put in 3 years for $2 a day. That was my pay during mm-hmm. the war.
And you almost lost your life, and you saw others lose their lives.
Yeah, we never thought about that. As far as the fighting going on, we just did the best we could. I'd go again if it was up to me to go.
And I don't think there's anybody listening who doesn't believe those words. That's Al Peguero, 91 years old. Check out his photos at hometownheroesradio.com or pull us up on Facebook. Al explained why his glasses weren't free and the price of so much that we take for granted continues to be paid by our men and women in uniform today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.